Welcome to the MedTech Talk Podcast, episode 163. We are pleased to deliver this presentation from the MedTech MVP Hybrid Conference this past September on demand. This panel presentation is titled Venture Investing in a Post-COVID World and was moderated by our host, Jeff Pardo, General Partner, Guild Healthcare. Now we'll kick things off. Over to Jeff.
It's really a thrill to be here, and in particular, you know, pulling together this panel was exciting for me because I think each one of them not only has a stellar track record, but really represents different styles of investing, different geographies, and just a very different perspective. And I think we're going to be able to get into some of that during this panel. And so what I'd like to do, actually, to kick it off, we thought it would be fun. I'll have each of them introduce themselves. But as part of that, also talk about a deal that they recently did, as well as an exit. And I think that would be a fun way to kick it off and really get a sense of each person's philosophy and style. And why don't we just start with Carter McNabb, River Cities, to my left.
Is this working? All right, great. Thanks, Jeff. Pleasure to be here. So River Cities, based in Cincinnati, office in Raleigh, been around really since the mid-90s, but heavy healthcare investors starting in the sort of early 2000s, investing out of our sixth fund to date. So our latest exit was a company called Bardy Diagnostics, remote cardiac monitoring. That's been mentioned a few times here. It's really a fast follower to iRhythm. If you're familiar with that company, sort of drafted behind a lot of the work that they had done, good product, really great go-to-market strategy, and sold to Hillrom for close to $400 million, which is a great exit for us. Interestingly, and actually I won't say this because unless you're going to bring up Varin, but I was going to bring up the last few exits that we've had have been to non-traditional, or not the Fortune 500 med tech, which I think has been a good sign for the industry. It's really hard to build a company that moves the needle for some of these big companies. So nature abhors a vacuum, and we've got some smaller mid-cap companies starting to be acquisitive, and I think that's a good sign. The latest investment that we made, it was sort of a tie. We made two investments basically in the same week. One was in a neuroendovascular access company, but temporarily later in the week was a company called Checkpoint Surgical. Checkpoint is in the peripheral nerve care market, sort of a burgeoning leader in this market where they have a disposable, they've got an implantable, and they help surgeons, ENTs, orthopedic hand surgeons, plastics, sort of peripheral nerve surgeons, do a bunch of things, but one, avoid making an injury to a nerve during a surgery. They help them repair nerves. They help them alleviate pain for nerve injury. And ultimately, the goal is to help optimize nerve regeneration. So that was the latest deal.
Yeah, very cool. Darshana?
Thanks, Jeff, and thanks for the conference and inviting me. I'm Darshana Zaveri. I'm a managing partner and founder of Catalyst Health Ventures. We are an early stage med tech fund based in Boston. We're typically seed through Series B investors when we start the relationship with a company, and then typically we'll invest in every subsequent round through to exit. Recent exit, I actually want to mention a couple. One is more recent than another, but both are in women's health, which I think I wanted to mention that when Jeff asked me the question. And, you know, everybody here knows women's health has been a particularly challenged space for a long time. It's been a space of underinvestment. And we think one of the reasons for that is because there haven't been too many exits in the space. So it results in a cycle of underinvestments by VCs. So the most recent one, a couple of months ago, our company, Sera Prognostics, went IPO on the NASDAQ. This is a molecular diagnostic company that is developing diagnostic tests to improve maternal health and neonatal health, with their first test being a test for preterm birth. So really exciting company, and actually one of the very few pre-revenue diagnostic companies that was able to take advantage of the IPO market. Before that, a couple years ago, though, it was Envision Medical, which you know about, and that was an ovarian cancer diagnostic tool. And again, I bring those two up because they were both in women's health, and there's been more activity recently in women's health, but traditionally has not been that hot a space to invest in. Envision was also an intersection of women's health and interventional oncology, which is another space that we really like. So the most recent investment I'll mention, and you know, it's been a really active year. We've closed about 6 transactions in the last 18 months. I'll mention one in particular, which is also interventional oncology. It's a company out of MIT that has developed a biopolymer to direct drugs to solid tumors where they're needed. And the reason I bring this particular one up is that, you know, Jeff, you asked me what are the things that we're seeing during COVID times that are unusual. And I mentioned Panther because it's a 3.5-person team that went from a preclinical to a clinical stage company in less than 6 months, despite enormous challenges of COVID, including backlogs and sterilization and a huge number of other challenges. So very exciting and happy to be part of it.
Tara.
So Tara Butler, thanks for being here. I am with Ascension Ventures, and our latest device exit was also Bardy Diagnostics. It's a small world, so now I will have to come up with a second one, but actually been going to go back a few years, and rather than do that, because I've migrated to some earlier stage investing, either that or I'm kind of dead in the water as an investor, let's just stick to Bardy, which is also possible. But clearly, given Darshana's comments, I do believe my portfolio, some of the exits have been affected by the COVID cycle, but still, so hopefully I'll, if I'm on a panel like this a year from now, I'll have some news with regard to exit. But as far as a recent, let me mention two recent deals, maybe it helps highlight the stage and areas that I'm just migrating towards. One is a company called Storm Bio, which it's not quite device, but it is a gene therapy platform that's looking at gene therapy for sickle cell disease. I think cell therapy is increasingly of interest to my limited partner base as we're starting to see some of these therapies reach the marketplace. And as I should have said, Ascension Ventures, our limited partner base is all integrated delivery networks. So I hope as a device investor to find some ways to play in cell therapy, perhaps more purely in device. But this was a way of dipping the toe in the water with something that's purely it is a cell therapy. It doesn't have a device related to it. The other one that probably is more relevant to this group is a company called Regioni, and in the same vein as Darshana's comments, Regioni is looking at innovations to improve outcomes in intrauterine procedures. I think it has the potential to move towards almost any pathology in the uterus, depending on that's surgical in nature that I can think of. And again, I'm trying to figure out whether it's just as I get older, getting more interested in my roots as an OB-GYN, but I think it's more than that. I do believe that from my perspective, and it's nice to hear it echoed from you, Darshana, that this area of women's health is moving a little beyond some of the, and I know these were big money makers, but I consider them kind of incremental advances in things like endometrial ablation. Obviously we need better methods of sterilization, but I feel those areas are well trodden. One, of course, looks at the increase in hysteroscopic surgery, where there's some interesting companies that are really emerging there and creating new markets. I think this particular area of women's health is particularly interesting to me because I still am fundamentally a little bit surgical at heart and recognize that that's one area that will, just continue to be an interesting area for device investment. As I said, I can't imagine anyone who's going to come up with a when someone comes up with a minimally invasive, a non-invasive C-section, then I'm probably out of work. So,
Justin.
Justin Klein, one of the partners at Ventsana. On the exit front, proud to say that we've been investors in Nadim's company, CBRX, which had an IPO this summer, about 1 year to the day from when we invested. So that seems like that was really fast and easy. I think Nadim complains a lot, but it seemed like nothing to us. No, in seriousness, though, as part of the NEA team, we know the time that went into that project and the commitment and all the hard work, and are proud to be investors in that with Jeff and a great syndicate. On the new investment front, one of our more recent investments is a company called Appella. This is a company in the digital surgery space that, interestingly, was founded by a collection of co-founders that came together with very diverse backgrounds. One led the sort of marketing and digital surgery work for Auris. Another, the CTO, was actually one of the first engineers at Facebook who built out their sort of data streams and algorithms that drive everything that really drives that business. And then a third who's got a lot of commercial experience in the med tech and surgery space. And Appella is developing sort of the system of record and a platform for driving efficiency in the operating room, which accounts for probably 60% of the profits of all hospitals in the country and are surprisingly inefficient for a bunch of systematic reasons that we think technology can better address. So we're excited about that one and partnered with Kasdan and Partner Fund on that one. So.
Yeah, and I think one of the really, and I've had a chance to really look through the portfolios of each of you, and one of the things that's really interesting is just the diversity of things from digital surgery to women's health. I mean, it's not just cardiovascular anymore. I mean, the breadth of investing is really exciting. You know, the topic of this panel was investing in a post-COVID world, which seemed, I guess, whoever came up with that was pretty optimistic about where we'd be today. But and I'm not sure we'll ever really get post-COVID, truly post-COVID. But what I'm really interested in is how COVID has impacted investment strategies. And maybe we'll lead with Tara on this topic. And I'm curious, during the past 18 months or so, has COVID, how have you been dealing with from an investment standpoint and from investment strategy? Has it altered it? Is it more business as usual, albeit, you know, more remote? How have you been dealing with it?
So, Jeff, on the level of investment strategy, it really has not altered my investment strategy. I think I fundamentally am looking for device-based innovations that are going to change some standard of care, but are really, you know, in our world, it's built to withstand the test of time. Some of when you're working, I tend to gravitate towards the still somewhat implantable interventional therapies, and those that particular strategy of investing, which has continued to be my focus. I believe that a chance to cut still is a chance to cure. That's how it's playing out in the practical world, although we are clearly moving towards more digital health. In that particular area of investing, it hasn't changed how I invest. But I'm interested I am still primarily a device-based investor, I think. And I'm be interested in some of the other folks here, because clearly there's a range.
Yeah, and we, you know, as investors, we have the luxury maybe of being able to look long term. But Darshan, as you're going in at earlier stages, often in things that have a clinical trial ahead of them. How has it impacted your thinking? And what have you seen maybe entrepreneurs doing to adapt to this particular period of time?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I think as we sit here today, it's a little different from how it was 12 months ago when there was a lot of uncertainty. I think right now the uncertainty is a little less, although as you said, this is probably something we're going to have to live with for a long time. And so to the extent that we can adapt the way we do things going forward, is kind of how we're thinking about it. It's not a short-term thing anymore. It's really how we're going to do business moving forward. In terms of our strategy and what we're looking for, that really hasn't changed. I mean, for sure, we saw tons of COVID-related technologies and opportunities, but fundamentally, we're not going to change our thesis, and we're still device-based investors like Tara is, and we're still interested in areas of big unmet need and strategic interest, like cardiovascular, like oncology, like pain. In terms of sort of how we do the deals, you know, I think that is the part personally for me that is evolving. We, as I said, we closed a lot of transactions in the last 18 months, but they were mostly with people we already knew. You know, our diligence sometimes can take a very, very long time. We get to know the entrepreneurs, especially because we're early stage and we know these relationships are going to last for 5 years, 8 years, 10 years. So now that we've sort of, you know, completed those deals and are now looking for new ones, I don't know how that's going to shape up with not being able to meet people in person, not being able to have dinner with them, not being able to have lunch with them. It's hard. So that part I think is still evolving, and we'll see how it shapes up.
You did a deal without going to the company, right?
I did, yeah.
You got to tell us about that.
Right. I mean, it's different, right? I mean, as Darshana said, like being able to meet, sit down with the entrepreneurs, see the operations. I mean, not doing that, it is a level of additional risk. I should have talked to you about, only doing deals with entrepreneurs that you know. But yeah, I mean, it is a different environment, but I mean, it is the amazing part of the technology we have today that we could have done that without.
Jeff, I want to mention one more thing, because you did mention clinical trials and how these entrepreneurs are going to adapt to doing clinical trials in this new world. And I think one of the things we look for in entrepreneurs is that nimbleness, mm-hmm. and the resourcefulness to be able to do a lot of things in a very capital efficient way in a resource constrained world where there are so many limitations. And we have found, by and large, our companies have been able, there are delays, there's no doubt, there's delays of, you know, anywhere from 3 months to 6 months, but they have generally been able to pivot to new locations, new strategies, new clinical sites. It's really been awe-inspiring, and I would love to hear from others, but how these entrepreneurs have managed to navigate the COVID world.
How have you seen that, Justin, in your portfolio, and the ability of entrepreneurs to navigate this?
Well, it's been remarkable. I think it's one of the hallmarks of great entrepreneurs. They're problem solvers. And if anything characterizes our companies, it's a series of unexpected events you have to react to and figure out how to execute, you know, new versions of your plan against. I think in a lot of ways, you know, the delays or the headwinds we've all seen from COVID are things that teams have had to figure out how to navigate around, whether it's site of care or working with suppliers, even thinking through very carefully how things like clinical endpoints, you know, may be affected on both sides of a trial, like in a randomized study. One remarkable story we like to tell is in one of our companies who we invested in, and right in the midst of COVID really accelerating in the spring and early summer of 2020, were headed off to do some of their first in man cases, which they were very carefully trying to select clinical sites for around the world, both South America and over in Eastern Europe. And, you know, at that time, COVID was entirely unpredictable. You know, week to week, month to month, different geographies in the United States or elsewhere were either completely shut down or coming back around and open. And this team had the idea that they would actually really concentrate on executing a very focused 10 or 15 patient clinical experience at one site in Eastern Europe. And they chartered a private plane, picked up members of the clinical team outside of the company, including physician investigators and other team members, and flew everybody over to that site, knocked out at least a dozen cases in about 4 days, and then came back. And when you think about, wow, okay, first time I've ever heard one of our startup companies say, you know, we're going to charter a plane for $200,000 just to go do some cases, like in another environment, you know, that wouldn't fly at the board meeting. These guys actually saved probably 6 months, you know, by just taking a step back and thinking about how do we really get this done and navigate all the issues associated with travel and safety and, you know, clinicians outside who are obviously motivated to help patients, but themselves are thinking about, you know, how do I deal with COVID? It was a remarkable example of ingenuity and creativeness and problem solving. And so we've seen a lot of examples like that. And that's what we like being a part of.
And then, that's a wonderful example. And I think that I'd say it, even in my companies, though, it continues to somewhat, that thinking continues to this day. I mean, for example, and I would say that even the ingenuity needs to go on. For example, I've companies and studies in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease patients, chronic bronchitis, where these folks are still avoiding the ERs, right, for these admissions. Another company with a trial in trauma, in hemorrhage and trauma, and you know, these, the both of them are developing solutions that they will be commercial. They will be working with patients, but you know, you only need to know a few physicians who are practicing to say it's still something that's living with us now. I know one of the things you asked me, Jeff, was is COVID behind us? I mean, I think I almost look at that in sort of a commonsensical way because, of course, I'm in the middle of a bunch of healthcare systems. These patterns in the patterns of flow of patients in the emergency room in particular have changed. And when you're working with some critical, what I've noticed as an investor working in critical illnesses, you know, heart failure, I mentioned chronic bronchitis, I mentioned hemorrhage. That's why I'm in this business. It really continues to be a challenge.
Yep.
But you know, elective, the positives, if you were to move to like elective, my companies that are doing elective surgeries, some that are the site of care, for example, is at home. They have been, I'm seeing the elective surgeries. I expect this should be a good year. It seems to be a little more behind us. I think the at site at home are those companies that got that tailwind from COVID. I think we probably all have one of those. I had a company doing a clinical trial and of all things, stress urinary incontinence, but it was it's a product that was worked, that was being studied in a home setting, didn't have a hiccup in the pace of the trial. So it's still something that's living with me, particularly in most of these critical care focused companies, which really are quite, you know, that's where I like to play. Yeah. So.
And Carter, what do you see as things that could persist out of the way we've been doing business? I mean, are we going to take some of the things that have developed over this period of time and it's going to persist beyond, you know, at least this, you know, current COVID situation? Or how do you view it? Are we going to get back to, you know, being in person all the time, or, you know, or in terms of the way these companies are doing business, do you think there's some permanent changes that have taken place?
Well, I think there are certainly some permanent changes, and I really think it's very based on, you know, where you domicile yourself. I mean, we have offices in Ohio and North Carolina. I spend a lot of time in Texas and Tennessee, and you know, they couldn't be more diametrically opposed to the way, you know, Bostonites are approaching COVID. So their problems are the same, but just the way the populace defines itself and likes to interact. So I think personal interaction and seeing someone face to face, people are starting to realize how important that is. And I don't think it'll go away, but I think it will be augmented. There won't be four or five in-person board meetings a year. I think there'll be at least one or two, well, I think would be the major component. But the ramifications are pretty dire. I'm fortunate enough to sit on the board of UC Health, which is the big academic medical center in Cincinnati. And some of the scar tissue that they're experiencing from this is going to ripple through all of, you know, acute care. You know, lack of people, you know, the clinicians on site having to choose who gets ECMO because they, you know, because they just don't have the technicians to run them. And I think the behavioral trauma on the people that do the care, I'm not sure how that plays out over time, but I think it's tremendous.
Yeah, I think the impact to our customers, as you mentioned, I mean, their budgets are extremely tight now, just given everything that's happened, the staffing shortages, and so how they sort of survive through this period of time and the long-lasting ramifications and how we adapt to that is going to be important. You know, I think as, you know, Justin's been instrumental in leading really the innovation around reimbursement that is so critical to our company's survival. And I think we all recognize there needs to be some sort of bridge to coverage, that it's almost an impossible situation when you're trying to get coverage and trying to prove widespread usage and basically don't get any money for the procedures once you're approved by the FDA. Obviously, MCID had a bit of a setback, but love, Justin, to kick off this next topic with your thoughts around MCID and maybe what's next and what's the potential for something else coming in its place.
Yeah, and for those that may not be aware, MCID is the Medicare Coverage for Innovative Technologies proposed rule that would have provided companies that have breakthrough designation and FDA approval 4 years of coverage for Medicare beneficiaries immediately upon FDA approval. I think one of the challenges that we've seen is for companies that are truly first in class, creating categories where you don't have an existing reimbursement framework, and you also need to prove, you know, your clinical validity, navigate a frequently, you know, novel regulatory paradigm, and even develop that paradigm with FDA. That process can take, honestly, 15 to 20 years, if you really think about when companies get started, how they navigate those paths, and then when you finally have coding, coverage, and payment in place, and you can start to scale a business commercially, it doesn't work when the average venture fund's life is 10 years. Right? Those first 3 rounds of financing, you know, really are sort of hard to justify. And so we thought about trying to take, you know, a relatively small slice of our most important innovations in med tech and make sure that they could get coverage more quickly and, of course, access for Medicare beneficiaries. There have been some challenges to that and some concerns, you know, within CMS and others about how we go about, frankly, understanding what types of technologies those are, whether and how they're appropriate for Medicare beneficiaries. And the rule was recently proposed to be repealed, and we're in the midst of a comment period where CMS would like to invite not only feedback on the idea of repealing it, but also maybe some input on how else they could revisit the idea. So my expectation is that we're going to continue to push for this. I mean, I think a fundamental challenge is that CMS is just very under-resourced. Well, I've heard actually today two different companies on stage cite that CMS discouraged them from pursuing things like parallel review. Or, you know, other pathways that CMS will talk about that companies have access to for getting coverage and coding a payment together, but they really don't have the capacity to navigate, certainly, as we continue to send them new innovative technologies, you know, with FDA support. So I think we do really need to address these issues around timeline and therefore the related costs and the delays that patients see. And we will probably focus on trying to further craft what types of innovations might be able to access a more expedited coverage pathway and figure out the ways in which CMS can get involved in the process for understanding, you know, what evidence will be developed not only before they're approved, but also after. And so making sure that they have, you know, appropriate input on the things that have historically gone into their determinations or what's reasonable and necessary, you know, for the health and well-being of Medicare beneficiaries. But it's complicated. And, you know, I expect we'll learn a lot more over the next probably 60 days in the process that's at hand, and certainly invite all of our entrepreneurs and investors, members of the community to have input on this. It's probably the first step in a series of things we need to do to improve reimbursement. But we think it's a potentially really important lever, and it'd be a great place to start.
Yeah. And we're going to actually in about 3 or 4 minutes open the floor up for some questions from the audience. And I think Nadim and maybe Kirk are with microphones. So hopefully some of you will prepare some questions. And similar to what Stacy did, I want to do sort of rapid fire questions for, because we've got a lot of topics that we haven't covered. And maybe I'll start with Tara on the reimbursement question, because I think with one of your companies, Renovia in particular, you're seeing kind of the rise of consumerism and patient pay. And how, and you know, these high deductible plans, I think, are also sort of promoting out-of-pocket payments. How are you seeing that play out? Are patients really amenable to paying for their health care?
So we're seeing that in Renovia, and then some of the other companies that we follow. I think, you know, it is for me a bit of an exception to make an investment in a digital health company such as that one, which really does. It is a bit digital health based, but I think it depends. I look at it as depending on the actual market. There are certain markets where I'm a commonsensical investor, and yes, I an OB-GYN, you say, yes, patients are willing to pay out of pocket for certain things. I made a bet on a data driven pelvic floor health innovation because of where I see this field of women's health going, peripartum and postpartum, and that's the bet. I think there's some other examples out there that are examples. I know I have to mention that, you know, Renee is in the audience. I follow Cala Health as an example of a company that is a digital solution that is in the market today. And I see these as examples of where consumerism. I haven't researched this. This is just experiential and what I see. I believe this is an avenue as an investor who is. I'm going out on a limb here. I mean, I've spent 20 years investing in these. I still continue. I'm with these long-term implantable plays that take 15 years for reimbursement, and we need investors to do that, and we need entrepreneurs to continue to do that. But I also believe that consumerism in the right markets with the right science underneath it, those is very important, that it's, for me, that these are, we're approaching the consumer with very good clinical science, that is an avenue for us device investors to move the needle on innovation without becoming pure digital. It's, to me, it's that area in which I can't think of many devices which don't have some sort of digital component to it. That's where my mind's going. So I hope I'm answering your question. It's not very articulate, but yes, I'm excited about that avenue, but I think time still is determining it.
Coming from Cincinnati, where P&G is based, there's a lot of consumer activity, and you see the skill set and breadth of experience that they bring to launching a product, and it's pretty daunting when you try to dabble in that. And I think our collective ecosystem here, we have a dearth of knowledge about how you do that, how you do it effectively. I think Silicon Valley does it really well, and there's a lot of examples of it. But I agree with you. You can't ignore it. It's coming, and I think I would urge people to bring those skill sets onto the teams earlier to understand those challenges, because they're very different from our typical B2B selling sort of experience.
Yeah. All right. So maybe I'll ask the audience to ask any questions if they have them. We have plenty of other topics to get into here, but if anybody has a question they'd like to ask, wave over. Oh, Nadim or someone else with a microphone. But maybe Darshana, one of the other topics while we wait to see if there are questions that I wanted to cover is really the funding gap that exists for early stage companies. And of course, you guys are very well positioned to be that, that backer. And I think there's a handful of other funds, James Eadie's out there at Sante, and they do a lot of early stage investing. But what are you seeing out there with entrepreneurs? It's one of the things I've worried about. I mean, as a late stage investor, is how you keep that pipeline going. But what are you seeing out there? How are, outside of Catalyst backing them, how are they getting funded?
No, I think there's a few investors in this room, but just a handful, right, that are doing early stage med tech. And you're right. I mean, this has been an issue for over a decade now. And there was a time when there was a lot of investment for early stage med tech, but it's been dwindling over the years. I think in the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a little bit of a change. We've seen capital coming back into the early stage market, but it has largely, in my experience, it's been through non-traditional sources. So it hasn't been traditional venture funds starting to do early stage med tech. It's been corporate ventures. You know, I think the strategics are looking at this problem and saying, where do we get our next acquisitions from if these early stage companies don't get funded? So we're seeing a lot of corporate venture activity. In fact, if there is any competition in deals, that's who it is with, from our perspective. Because most venture funds are, you know, collaborative in that sense. And then, or there's a lot of family office money. There's a lot of, you know, money from overseas. There's Chinese capital that's coming in. There's, you know, hedge funds. We've seen some hedge funds going into early stage deals. So I think there's a lot of non-traditional capital that is giving some impetus to the med tech market. But, you know, our worry is always that, that it can go away just as quickly as it came, right? I mean, it's all depends on market conditions you know, how the general overall market is doing, whereas the steady early stage venture funds have, it's pretty much been the same 10 to 12 funds that do these deals. So I think that's where we need to see more of a structural change.
Yeah.
And I know you'd asked me a question on by email about this. This is again an anecdote of one, but I did speak to a later stage medtech investor who's considering raising their next fund with the premise that 10 to 20% will go into early stage deals. And I think that is because they want to take advantage of companies that will essentially never get to a later stage, right? These are companies that will get acquired prior to FDA approval or prior to revenue. And so those are real opportunities for medtech investors.
And that's, okay, we got a question. Venk.
Thanks, Jeff. Venk Varadhan with Nanoware. Good to see you all. We touched upon it a little bit when we talked about the consumerism and digital push that obviously has been accelerated by COVID. There's also, I guess, downward pressure from policymakers. We're pushing a lot out to acute surgical procedures, out to acute surgical centers. There's a lot of need for home-based care now. So how do you guys sort of bridge that with the need for digital? And what do you guys, I think we'll touch upon in the next panel, how do you guys see like data-driven diagnostics or AI sort of fitting into to that new model where you've got pressure from both the consumer side as well as the provider and payer side?
Who wants to tackle that one?
Well, I will give you my... So I work in a fund where I believe it's very hard from my perspective as a fundamental device investor to tackle AI and digital health head on. I think it's a really important area for all device investors to learn about and start developing skills or partnerships with folks who really do understand it. I've approached it we have a siloed fund. For example, if you came to me with a digital health AI based therapy, I honestly punted over the fence to my tech colleague, but we work very closely together. I personally am someone who believes that to do it really well, you need a bit of a combination of skills. Of course, I'm a little bit older than folks here, but I also think it's absolutely fundamental to where devices to the direction that all med tech is taking. So.
And Jeff, I mean, you guys just did a deal in Clearly. Are you more oriented to things that kind of fit in the normal clinical workflow as opposed to getting the consumer involved? Or how do you view kind of that convergence of things that Venk was talking about?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think broadly, you know, in part accelerated by COVID, you know, patients are increasingly willing to adapt, you know, technologies they've used in other parts of their lives and how they get their healthcare. So we do think about places where products or care pathways can be designed that incorporate everyone, right, from the physician to the patient, and sometimes even the payer who wants visibility. Ultimately, you know, maybe to answer Venk's question as part of this, I think that I always believe med tech, whether it's a device or some of the kind of enabling technology, in part is helping facilitate the transition of procedures from frequently more invasive, you know, higher morbidity surgeries into catheter-based or less invasive, you know, procedures. And frequently that's enabling things to move out of the hospital into, you know, lower cost of care settings. And I think digital is kind of a natural extension of that. So the more we can do to extend where care can be optimally delivered, I think there are opportunities to apply those things like information technology or data or analytics and make all these things better. I don't think we'd invest on AI because it's AI. We have to think about how it ultimately impacts care delivery. And for us, you know, maybe like a company like Clearly, we're very clinical outcomes driven. So we'd look for the same types of things that validate, you know, the utility of something digital as we would a mechanical device,
yeah,
or a product or procedure like that.
I know we're over time, but I want to thank everybody for all the insights and comments. And
thanks, everybody.